The crime of passion defense in halakha. What we're going to talk about in this shiur is the question of whether halakha recognizes the claim that a particular act was a crime of passion as a legitimate defense in halakhic criminal law. That is to say, whether one can evade punishment, or at the least mitigate punishment, because one's action was committed under internal compulsion, that even though one does not admit being genuinely insane, overall, one claims to have been in a situation in which a sane person could not control themselves under the weight of particular emotions. Now, at first glance, it would seem that halakha and Torah have a deep theological objection to the claim that when human beings are ever not capable of controlling themselves. The message of Torah is that human beings are in fact capable of choosing good over evil, of choosing life over death, and therefore the whole task of the human being is to control their impulses towards evil. So to say that one should not be held responsible because of one's emotions can, prima facie, be seen as going against the entire thrust of Torah. Furthermore, we should note that the crime of passion defense in Western law, I believe most famously in the Code of Napoleon, tended to be applied in a very particular case, which is when one spouse found the other spouse engaged in sexual activity, in flagrante delicto, I think is the term, and was so overcome by emotion that they killed either the adulterous spouse, the third party, or whomever. And usually this is a husband finding a wife in bed with somebody else and killing the wife and her lover. So the classic example of the crime of passion defense in Western law is when the emotions aroused by the marital relationship or by a sexual relationship overcome one's capacity to obey the law. We'll see that if in fact halakha recognizes such a case, one of the prime examples will be a reverse case in which the passion for law overcomes any natural inclination towards forming a marital relationship. So you'll see whether you think it's in fact the same thing. But I'm starting with the premise that the burden of proof is against such a claim, and I want to see if, in fact, one can, despite that, construct a compelling case that halakha recognizes this defense, or at least that there is a strand in halakha that recognizes such a defense. Now, the first case, historically, within the world of rabbinic Judaism, in which such a plea was made, is really at the very beginning of the Jewish nation, immediately after the revelation at Sinai, Matan Torah, the Jews commit the sin of the golden calf, and Moshe Rabbeinu attempts to defend the Jews to God for committing the golden calf, and that turns us to source number one. And source number one begins with the phrase V'dizahav. V'dizahav is part of a list of places at the very beginning of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, which are the places at which Moses delivered the speech, which forms the book of Devarim. The problem is that those places do not conform to the list of places that the Jews visited in the desert according to the end of Sefer Bamidbar of Numbers. Therefore, the rabbis concluded that the names used for places in the beginning of Sefer Devarim must be symbolic. They must represent something of events rather than actually be the names of places. So what is represented by the name Dizahav? So here we have the Talmud and the Tractate Brachot, Lamed Bet Amud Aleph, page 32a, quoted saying the following, "My Dizahav, what is meant by the name Dizahav? Amri Devei Rabbi Yanai, the house of Yanai said, so said Moses before the Holy One who is blessed. Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, b'shvil kesed v'zahav shehishpacha lahem b'Yisrael ad she'amru di, hu garam she'asu et ego. It's the silver and gold that you Testament that you poured out for the Jews until they said enough. Right? So V'di Zahav becomes the Dai Zahav, right? Which Dai means enough. So you gave them Dai Zahav, so much gold that they said enough. That's what caused them to commit the sin of the golden calf. Okay, how is it that God can be held responsible for the Jews' sin simply because he gave them too much good? So the Talmud continues with the following analogy. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said the name Rabbi Yochanan. Mashal, I'll give you a parable to explain what Moshe Rabbeinu's argument was. Le'adam echad shehaya lo ben. There's a person who had a son. Yechitzo, he bathed him, v'sacho, and he anointed him, or perfumed him, v'echilo, and he fed him, v'ishkahu, and he gave him drink, just probably intoxicating drink, v'talalo kifal tavaro, and he put a locket or some kind of container of perfume, right? A perfume, I guess we would say cologne, on his neck. And then he takes this dressed up, well fed, possibly somewhat inebriated son, and he puts him at the doorway of a brothel. What could that boy do not to sin? So the analogy seems to be that when overwhelmed with quantities of gold and silver, it's the nature of human beings to worship them. And therefore, God caused the sin of the golden calf by giving them so much gold and silver that the Jews had no choice but to worship it. Now, this argument, Moshe Rabbeinu's argument for the Jews, is not necessarily accepted by God. It's very ambiguous as to how God reacts to Moshe's plea. He ends up not destroying the Jews utterly. On the other hand, the punishment of the golden calf is visited on the Jews in every generation when they sin. So it's not clear how effective this claim of Moshe Rabbeinu that the Jews were placed in a situation in which they could not control themselves, what I would call a crime of passion situation, passion for gold in this case. It's not clear that God accepts Moshe Rabbeinu's argument even as a mitigating factor, but possibly it functions as a mitigating factor. What's also not clear, right? That's the nimshal, right? The object of the parable. But what about the actual case? What would Rav Chiya bar Abba have said, or Rav Yochanan have said, if an adolescent came before him, charged with patronizing a brothel, and the defense was, well, my father bathed me and fed me and perfumed me and gave me drink and put me down in the doorway. How could I not go in? Would we take that as a claim legitimate to avoid responsibility or not? And that question, I don't know. I don't think that there is any real evidence in halakha one way or the other as to how we take it. But here we have the first instance of such a plea. It may or may not have been effective in the use of Moshe Rabbeinu, even as a mitigating factor. It seems to me that Rav Chiya bar Abba and Rav Yochanan would at least have taken it as a mitigating factor. I don't know if they would have taken it as a complete exemption. I doubt it very much. But at least as a mitigating factor. Okay. That brings us to source number two. Source number two is found in the Tosfot, Tractate Shabbat, Davdal Amar Aleph Dibur HaMasil Ki, page 4a in Tractate Shabbat. Tosfot quotes the following case. So in the case of a woman who was half slave and half free, meaning that you had a female slave who was owned by two masters, one of whom gave her a writ of manumission, so that she's now half free. So such a woman is ineligible for marriage at all, because as a slave she cannot marry a free Jew, as a Jew she cannot marry a slave, and if she were to find somebody in the same position that the halacha is that we don't match up the halves, but we say that they cannot marry each other either. So such a woman is in a position in which she is ineligible for marriage, and therefore it seems that the men of the population treated her as fair game. They treated her licentiously. And therefore, v'chasuid rabba. So the rabbis of the time forced the remaining master to free her. And they said that one should not, a slave should not long endure half slave and half free. So Tosfot wants to know, there is a rabbinic principle, that the halacha is, that there is a prohibition against freeing, we're dealing here with a Canaanite slave. In a different share, I'll discuss why there should be such a prohibition and why we can view such a prohibition as an affirmation of autonomy rather than as a denial. But let's just take it at face value here that there is a prohibition against freeing Canaanite slaves. So on what grounds do we force the remaining master to commit a halachic crime, really, of freeing a Canaanite slave? So thus it says, Mishum Shahita Nechazeret Omotia Atzma Liznut, because this particular woman was acting lewdly. Right? She was making herself available for uncommitted sex. The Domim La'anusim, and therefore the men of the environment, it seems to me, that's what they're saying, are considered to be as if they were compelled. The Domim La'anusim, there's if they're compelled. There's no physical compulsion in the sense nobody is taking over their will, which, right, external compulsion, which Halakha certainly recognizes, but it seems that the availability of sexual relations without any responsibility is treated as an unconquerable temptation for men. And Tosfot says that rather than reacting to this by saying, well, control yourself, we recognize that such a compulsion requires us to act legally in ways we would not, in this particular case, to force somebody else to commit an act, or, depending on how you learn it, we declare that act, which, if purposeless, would be a violation, to not be a violation since it has a legitimate legal purpose. So here again, we have a case in which we say that under particular circumstances, people are not viewed as entirely responsible for their actions, such that we change the law because we treat them as if they were compelled. Now, again, I don't think that Tosfot read the Gemara as saying that were those men to be on trial for having extramarital sex, or for having sex with a slave, that we would absolve them of legal responsibility, of criminal responsibility, because they're discompelled. But we see that halacha does not treat one as equally responsible in all cases, because we don't, in cases where we don't see the temptation as extraordinary, as if they were compelled, they would not react legally to mitigate the situation. Okay. That brings us to source number three. Now, source number three, again, is a Tosfot found in Tractate Sanhedrin, Tet Amud Bet, Tractate Sanhedrin 9b. Tosfot there is explaining the position of Rava. Rava says that although the general position is that any Jew who regularly violates a biblical prohibition is thereby becomes invalid as a witness in halachic courts, because we presume that somebody who is willing to violate one biblical commandment will equally well violate the biblical commandment against bearing false witness. Right? We treat the violation of one biblical commandment as revelatory of character, and we say that a person who can't be trusted to follow one aspect of Torah should not be trusted to follow any aspect of Torah. However, Rava says that this does not necessarily apply to persons suspected of committing acts of heterosexual immorality. Why should that be? So Tosafot says, Inami, another explanation is, Hasam Kasher, people who are suspected of, or are known to have committed sexual immorality in a way that violates biblical law, are nonetheless still valid witnesses. Mishum Biyitro Tokfo Koltach, because their desire, their inclination overwhelms them to the point, the Chashiv Ka'onis, that they're considered as if compelled. So here again, it doesn't mean that we don't hold people criminally liable for their acts of, say, adultery. However, that doesn't necessarily disqualify them. I'm not sure the brother would go so far as adultery, but very possibly. It doesn't necessarily disqualify them as witnesses, because we can say that that particular action is not reflective of their character, because we view them as if they were compelled for this purpose. Right, so we have three different cases, one in the Talmud and two in Tosafot, and if you accept Tosafot's interpretation, we then have three cases in the Talmud, in which we recognize a plea of internal compulsion as having at least mitigating force in halacha. All this is brought together in, to some degree, it shows legitimacy, on the other hand, it's a reductio ad absurdum by the Or HaChaim commentary on Numbers 11:10, by Leibar Yud Aleph Yud, where he says, Shekol oseh rish'al etzad tikvor et ha-pitoi va-arevus, anybody who engages in an act of wickedness because of the power, right, because they're overcome by seduction and sweetness, desire for pleasure, yesh ladun bo tada onus. There's always room to look upon them without utter severity, because of the element of compulsion in human nature to be seduced by pleasure. So here again, clearly he's not talking about legal responsibility, but he is willing to say that all cases in which one acts out of desire for pleasure as opposed to out of desire to anger God should be seen as having a mitigating element. However, of course, the problem is that once we say that you can view this in almost every case, so clearly its legal force has to be very weak, because we don't refuse to apply a regimen of punishment. Although it might be that the Or HaChaim is part of the impetus behind the, for example, the position that several of them have, that one should, despite the fact that the Torah frequently prescribes the death penalty for crimes, that a court should make sure that it does not apply such a penalty more than once in every 7 years, or more than once every 70 years, or never, according to Rabbi Akiva. So it might be that that's because, although people who commit acts solely out of defiance of God, in fact, deserve such punishments, but anybody who acts out of desire should be seen as at least somewhat compelled, and therefore not be subject to the full severity of the law. Maybe. What we have so far, again, is a series of cases that seem to indicate that halacha recognizes at least some degree of impairment of responsibility, which generates mitigating circumstances, even when the compulsion is purely internal. And the phrase continually shows up that there is if they are compelled. And the analogy is explicit. The first move we have towards taking this more strongly and suggesting this might have halachic effect to the point of really absolving someone of legal responsibility, we can find in the commentary of Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, also one of the authors of the Tosafot, to Shemot Chaf Bet Aleph, Exodus 22:1. This is source number 5. So he's commenting on the phrase Mi b'machter kimatei haganav, which the Torah says that if somebody finds a thief entering their house furtively, right, they find the thief in a tunnel entering their house, and you kill that thief, so ein lo damim, right, we don't hold you responsible for the killing of the thief. So why not? So Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor explains this as following. Kilomar, what this means to say is, ein hamakeh nechshav kishoseich damim. Right, means the let's assume the owner of the house who strikes down the furtive thief is not considered to have shed the thief's blood, or is not considered to be a blood shedder. Sharei kimo anusu, because he, the householder, is as if compelled, She'en adam yachol hamiratu al mamono. Because people are incapable of restraining themselves when their money is at stake. And Isaiah Sibachor Shor says, it's not that one has a right to kill the furtive trespasser, but that we absolve you of criminal responsibility for killing the trespasser, because human beings can't restrain themselves when their money is threatened in their home. Okay, so it seems here that Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, using the same language as we saw in the previous sources, that somebody is considered as if compelled, here uses it to explain the law in the Torah, which says that actually you have no criminal responsibility at all. So it seems that Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, in principle, accepts the idea of a claim of crime of passion, in this case, passion for money, although aggravated, of course, by the notion that one is being violated by one having one's home invaded furtively. What we then have to figure out is, in evaluating Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, is number one, is he right in his explanation of this case? Is it really true that the reason a householder is not held liable for killing a furtive trespasser is because the householder is compelled? There might be another better reason that when we read the Talmud that we're convinced is the reason that the householder is not held responsible. And secondly, even if we were to decide that is the correct explanation of the case, is the Torah telling us in this case that the householder is not liable? Is the Torah thereby telling us that we can build from here, we can derive from here, a binyan av, we can use this as a paradigm to teach us the legitimacy of the crime of passion defense? Or is it saying that ordinarily this case is not such a defense would not be accepted, but here the Torah tells us this is the exceptional case? And this, by the way, I think is also a case I'm not going to cite in the context of this year, the case of Yisrael Tawar, of the attractive captive, whom one is allowed to take home and possibly or possibly not rape, where it seems in that case that Torah is acknowledging compulsion. So without even getting into that case, it seems to me very hard to generalize in that case. It seems to me that the point there is that what the Torah is saying is the chiddush. Even though you would never accept this, this case is so weird, so wild that we're going to allow it. And even there, it's not 100% clear. But here it seems to me there's a better chance of saying that we can derive from here the principle in general if we accept the Bechor Shor's reading, and then again if we could find some indication that somebody saw this as a paradigm and not as an exception. So let's first try and evaluate whether Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor's reading of this particular law is compelling. So to evaluate that, we have to go back to what is here source number 6 of the Gemara on Sanhedrin in Bet Amud Aleph, page 72a, which discusses this very case. Right, so the Mishnah begins by saying, Habava Machter Nidon al Shem Sofo, that a furtive trespasser is judged by his end. Okay, what does it mean to be judged by his end? So our Rava said, My Tamad Machteret. What's the reason that the householder is absolved for killing the furtive trespasser? Chazakash Ein Adam Amir Atzmo Mamuno. There is a rabbinic presumption, a legal presumption, that people do not restrain themselves when it comes to their money. The high Maimar Amar, so this furtive trespasser, this thief, is saying to himself, Iyaz Yilma, if I go and try and steal money from this house, Koyilapoy, the owner, will come face me. The thief is acknowledging the possibility that he will be discovered, even though he's trying to enter furtively. Roshavikli, and the owner will not allow me to take the money, or the owner will confront me. Vikoyilapoy, and so the thief is saying to himself, and prepared to say, well, if the owner confronts me, just the only way, I will kill the owner. That Torah Amra, Imbrol Hargacha Hashkei Mahargo. And the Torah says, which is a fun phrase, because in Rabbinic idiom, when it actually uses the words Torah Amra, right, the Torah says, what it really means is, that there is no explicit verse that says this, but we see this as a principle derivable from the Torah. In Bal Hargacha, if somebody comes to kill you, Hashkein Lahargo, then you should anticipate, hasten, and kill that person first. So what's the explanation of this case? It seems to me that one could read this case in two ways, very differently than the Horshor, and the Rishonim offers such readings. One possibility is that once the confrontation is initiated, so the thief is the one who makes it a capital confrontation, because the thief is the one who's prepared to kill. And the householder has no interest in killing. The householder just wants to protect his money. But the thief is willing to kill to get the money. And so now, once the confrontation happens, the householder is just there. The thief is now prepared to kill, and the householder is entitled to act out of self-defense. So you might ask, so why isn't the thief entitled to act out of self-defense? And in that case, maybe the householder has an obligation to leave. So one could argue that the householder has no obligation to leave. One could argue that we have here what is called an unclean hands doctrine, meaning that whether or not the householder should have left, since the thief committed the first wrong act, so when a wrong act creates an escalation, a vicious cycle of wrong acts done to each other, we hold the person who committed the first wrong act responsible. And therefore, the thief is considered to be the one who initiates the capital confrontation, even though the thief would be very happy if the owner said, take my money, I really have no interest in fighting. But because the thief committed the first wrong act of entering the house illegitimately, therefore we hold the thief responsible. The Horshor has the creative reading that, in fact, the owner is formally under obligation not to make this a capital confrontation. That confronted by the thief, right, if the owner cannot overpower the thief, the owner should let the thief get away. Or the owner should, and better yet, if the owner knows that the only way they will be able to stop the thief is by killing them, the owner should not initiate the confrontation. However, the Horshor says, once the owner initiates the confrontation, or better yet, the Horshor says that even though the owner should not initiate the confrontation, we don't hold the owner responsible for initiating the confrontation. And therefore, even though the owner could be considered a murderer, because if the owner had just not gone in there, the thief had no intention of killing him, so we could say that the owner really is the one who is the threat, and it's the thief who's acting out of self-defense. The Horshor says that we can't hold people accountable. Right, we can't say that you're obligated to not confront the thief who breaks into your house. That's not reasonable. So that's the Horshor reading, but as I say, it seems to me at least equally plausible to read the Gemara as the other Rishonim do and say that the issue here is an unclean hands doctrine, or that we genuinely view the thief as walking in and thereby initiating the capital confrontation. So what we have so far, I would say, is one Rishon who seems to suggest this, and one Rishon seems to suggest this. And again, we also don't know that he says this as a rule as opposed to simply as an explanation of this particular case.